Welcome to PsychoPharm Today, our podcast at ASCP in conjunction with Psychiatric Times. My name is Dr. Janessa Johnston. I'm the ASCP social media coordinator as well as a research fellow at the NIMH. And today I will be talking with Dr. James Murrow and Dr. Hiroi Hu on novel therapeutics with entactogenic effects and their role as a new frontier for mood and anxiety disorders, which is their focus of their panel at ASCP today. So I really want to focus on, as discussed in the panel, social anxiety, loneliness, and social anhedonia are all really cross-diagnostic mechanisms and targets that may be well-suited for entactogenic treatments. In your view, what clinical features or scenarios may prompt a clinician to consider an entactogen versus another more traditional antidepressant or medication?
So I think I will use one patient example that we recently had. This patient had very severe treatment-resistant depression as well as social anxiety disorder. And he was extremely socially isolated at home. Mm-hmm. And with him, it was a little bit hard to decipher whether the depression came first or social anxiety came first, but he definitely also had social anhedonia because even if his family called, he wouldn't answer. There was just like no drive, but he wasn't like a, you know, schizoid personality type where he was okay with being alone and lonely. He wanted that connection. So someone like that really made me think like, oh man, like I wish I could give EMP-01 or RMDMA here to sort of lower that psychological defense he had and also allow him to have more drive for connecting, like socially connecting with others so that he's building kind of this inherent protective factor that would, you know, further prevent any relapse for depression. Mm-hmm. So I hope that kind of illustrates, and I don't know if you can think of other patients.
It just sort of makes me think, I guess, big picture, what being part of what's, I think, exciting about as we're learning more about the brain from a transdiagnostic perspective, from social neuroscience, for example, and other things and different forms of anhedonia, we hope to get to a point where we're listening to the patient. So if we're hearing that sort of chief complaint or that feature in the history of sort of social isolation, but they want more isolation or sort of feeling like they wanted more connection, and the doctor can think about, okay, I can reach into my pharmacopoeia or psychotherapeutic arsenal, right? Mm-hmm. And match that complaint, right, as we say in medicine, with a treatment instead of, you know, again, we're always saying, I mean, we have a lot of evidence-based treatments, medicines and other things that are very effective, but it's a little bit of a blunt instrument in the sense that they present from a medical sort of diagnostic point of view, they have depression, and you have antidepressants. And you have a lot of antidepressants, but you have antidepressants, and they're kind of all sort of in the same bucket, right? Mm-hmm. And I think part of what's exciting about what's going on with enactogens, entactogens, neuroplastogens, rapidly acting therapeutics, ketamine derivatives, and we've actually seen a lot of exciting new targets and molecules just at this conference, you know, my hope is that there's just, we expand the toolbox so we can match drugs to patients and to meet their needs, you know.
Definitely. Kind of maybe going off that a little bit, you presented kind of this paper on the windows of entactogenic effects and their like kind of neuroplasticity windows of how they have, where ketamine's a little bit shorter but still has that kind of fast-acting peak where you can do that. But how can clinicians sort of capitalize and use these windows to help treat their patients a little bit better?
I think that's an excellent question. I think the paper that you were referring to from my slides was the Nardo et al. Paper in Nature that I think titled something like Psychedelics Reopen the Critical Social Reward Learning Period. And as a practicing psychiatrist as well, when I hear that, those different windows of effect, my first instinct is to want to pair it with some sort of behavioral intervention. Psychotherapy. If it's a suicidal crisis, then, you know, I think ketamine would be great because you only need that little amount of time. If it's more of like a long-standing, like substance use disorder, a long-acting one like LSD or, you know, ibogaine is very effective for SUD. So I think it sort of, like you said, match the drug to the patient. I'll definitely pair some psychotherapy and behavioral modification to leverage the neuroplasticity.
It seems like that's like so much of what we're seeing, whether it's integrating psychotherapy with psychedelics. There's been a lot of really cool work, as you know, pairing ketamine in the context of mood disorders with some type of behavioral or psychotherapeutic intervention. Even some work has explored even sort of computerized, you know, things that could be scalable, I think is really exciting. Also traditional forms of psychotherapy, figuring out there's sort of a whole set of thinking and research around matching the therapy that would come, or the, let's say, the behavioral non-pharmacologic, what comes after the drug, with what do we know about the drug, its pharmacology, things like that. I also thought I need to go back and find that paper that you showed because it's really cool. And that ibogaine, and the paper showed that ibogaine had looked like by far the longest, I guess, effect on, it was sort of a cellular molecular measure of enduring sort of plasticity potential. Was that what it was? Just interesting because it's been in the news so much recently, even though it's a drug that, if you look at all the drugs that are in clinical development and testing for mood disorders, depression, anxiety, that's not sort of as much. And, you know, there's some real risks and things like that, but it's a very, very interesting drug. And I did not know it had that distinct, very prolonged effect on neuroplasticity. So that's very interesting.
Both of you have dedicated a lot of time in your careers to looking at kind of biological underpinnings of mood disorders, and maybe less on the clinical side, but on the research side. What do you think separates entactogens from other therapeutics that we currently use and what they're actually doing within the brain?
Should we define entactogen for
the... It was on there too. Entactogen's a bit loosely defined, so it would be great if you could also
I mean, you should, because I yeah. It's your panel, and I was also learning.
There's the Nichols definition.
Yes. A lot of people are confused by what entactogens are, because it's not an intuitive word. It's interchange sometimes with the empathogen, which is easier to understand, you know, you're generating empathy.
Right.
But entactogen, the Latin word root, means to touch within. So in addition to promoting social affiliative behavior or pro-social behavior, it also turns attention inward, soften the psychological defense, and promote emotional openness, which I think inherently translates into connectedness with others, as well as kind of this deep introspection, like how the data for EMP-01 and social anxiety disorder showed.
And how we think about MDMA working in the context of psychotherapy with trauma and PTSD.
Right.
So empathogen and enactogen, they're related, right? In the sense it's about empathy for others, also for yourself. I think a lot of the thinking of how is MDMA in part therapeutic for severe trauma. You know, you hear these stories about people sort of being able to forgive themselves and other, which sort of it seems would all relate to.
Yes.
Are there, this is my own, I don't know this, can you classify molecules? Are there molecules that you could say this is more of an entactogen and this is more of an empathogen, or do they tend to go together and it's just sort of different ways of describing or can you actually put them in different buckets? Are there different, and is MDMA better considered an empathogen or entactogen? Because I'm pretty sure I've heard it described as an empathogen.
As well as
and maybe you'd say it is that, and it's that. Are there some drugs that are just one or the other?
So not to make things more complicated, but there is a paper that says the MDMA is a connectogen.
Okay.
Which in tactogenic and empathogenic effects. So I think the field is still trying to figure out what is what. I do know that the classification comes from the phenomenology of experience and not the molecule. Mm-hmm. But I think we're still at a stage where we're trying to figure out if there are other substances that have potential empathogenic and or entactogenic effects, including those in the psychedelic bucket.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And it's not uncommon, obviously, terminology. I mean, it's still a pretty young field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even psychedelic itself is not a completely settled. I mean, we think we know what we mean.
Right.
We were talking earlier. Even is ketamine a psychedelic? Yeah. We had ketamine in your panel. Certainly, we didn't traditionally think of it like that. So these are all terms that I guess that we just have to agree on what we mean. And you know, it's
yeah. I think there's a lot of terms in psychiatry that we still are a little bit loosely defined on. We keep on going.
It's not even
it.
Specific to this field. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. With thinking of turning inwards as this effect of entactogens, mm-hmm. is there any concern for maybe using this in disorders where there's already a hypervigilance or already kind of a hyper-focus on internal state? Mm-hmm. Or do you think it will actually help kind of rework those mechanisms and that negative valence that people usually associate, say, in anxiety?
I mean, I'll just say, I mean, just from the my understanding of the clinical effects of, for example, MDMA in PTSD, maybe some other context, it does seem like, so if you think of PTSD as well as anxiety disorders as having those features of being internally focused, there's a lot of data that even the neural systems, whether it's the anterior insula and other things that are sort of monitoring, these are sort of hypervigilant, these systems that are monitoring the body, a lot of internal focus, a lot of the distress from trauma disorders and PTSD is related to stimuli that are coming from within. You know, I mean, think about recurring memories and things. And there seems to be something about this class of drugs, maybe particularly when paired with certain types of therapeutic techniques, allow that a positive, whether it's reframing, processing. Again, I've heard so many times these anecdotal cases of people sort of forgiving themselves. There's often a lot of negative self-thinking, negative cognitions, shame, guilt, things like that in trauma. And there's something about these ways these drugs are working in the brain that's facilitating a more internal connection and more ability to forgive, more empathy towards the self, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that you mentioned. A lot of times in psychiatry, we're at the intersection of, do we think about this as purely biological, or do we think about this kind of like a psychoanalyst or psychodynamic person? I have a grad friend who is training to be a psychoanalyst, and she would probably argue that, it's probably softening the psychological defense, which is sort of, kind of the... it has commonality with what psychoanalysis do. Mm-hmm. So from a phenomenology, psychological process kind of way, I don't think internalizing everything is not always detrimental or bad.
Yeah. Completely. Changing gears a little bit, because MDMA has obviously been brought up, this is probably one of the most well-known entactogens or empathogens or connectogens, whatever term we're going to use throughout this. There was a fairly... largely publicized rejection of MDMA therapy by the FDA recently. And I was wondering maybe what researchers and clinicians could do to learn from that rejection, how we should design our trials to fully get the effects of entactogens and implement them into clinical practice.
Do you have any?
No, I mean, only that, look, I don't think we've heard the end of the story with this. I think, I remember seeing the data that was coming out of those programs in... they kept publishing in Nature Medicine. I don't know how many, I think it was twice. And then, there was very large clinical effects. And the reported tolerability looked very encouraging. I think a lot of people were very surprised at the rejection. And there's been a lot of discussion about that, why that is. But it seemed like a lot of the reasons it wasn't necessarily that the core sort of, is the drug safe? Is it effective? It was just there were important other issues that made it maybe the FDA wasn't as sure as they wanted to be to come to that conclusion. So I don't think we've seen the end of that story. Of course, you know, we can't use, in this case, we really can't use the drugs before they're approved. We probably shouldn't. I'm not cast shoulds. I'm not that, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Particularly these drugs, some drugs we can use off label, like ketamine is used off label for, you know, things. But so I think we're probably largely going to have to wait. But there's movement in this space. There's compounds like we were talking about from the panel this morning. There are sort of derivatives or molecules related to MDMA that seem to have these things, these effects. So I think we're going to see a lot of movement in this space within entactogens, entactogens and actogens, and broadly in psychedelics over the next 12, 24, 36 months. I think things are going to move pretty quickly, which is exciting.
I think one of our postdoc fellows did a journal club on that FDA rejection letter, and I think what she reported from reading the whole thing was, like you said, it wasn't an issue with the concept. It was more of an issue with methodological rigor and standardization. Also, the psychotherapy component. You know, I was hearing from someone from the FDA, and, you know, they're going to have to put a label on everything, and they also weren't sure how to put a label, you know, with the psychotherapy aspect. Just kind of like reiterating the point from our panel today, I think choosing your drugs, the investigational drugs, and your outcomes in a very methodical way is the key to move forward, I think.
Following off of that, do you think, obviously a lot of the talks today were focused within disorder, so generally within depression or within PTSD, but do you think there's room in this space to design trials that are specifically for people presenting with high social anhedonia or high loneliness and then going from there rather than just choosing a specific diagnostic bin to put people within?
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of transdiagnostic studies, and that's sort of the field I eventually want to go into, especially things like social anhedonia, where, you know, the people who investigate social anhedonia also recruit healthy volunteers, knowing that there are healthy volunteers without psychiatric diagnoses who score pretty high on the social anhedonia measures. And, you know, who's not to say they'll eventually develop mood or anxiety disorders, right? I think we're kind of moving towards this like DSM categorical research methodology to transdiagnostic methodology. So yes, I would be excited to do that.
Yeah, I'll just add, I think, you know, I also share the feeling that, you know, it's we sort of modern psychiatry inherited the nomenclature and the categorizations, right? Which aren't based on biological understanding, which is okay because we're still working on that, right? My guess is in the kind of immediate future, that like we're talking about, for example, psychedelics and related compounds, the FDA and the sponsors and everybody in the research communities is chewing on all kinds of big issues. These drugs are just so different than what we've studied, at least in sort of a modern regulatory framework. There were issues talked about, methodological issues, blinding, a huge issue, all these things that the role of psychotherapy, the FDA is not sure what to, the sponsors aren't sure what to, how do you, so I'm guessing if we come along and say, okay, now on top of all that, let's have the indication be social anhedonia and forget the sort of the classes that are the diagnoses that are recognized in the medical community and the insurance payers, right? That's just going to be a bridge too far. That's my feeling. I think slowly in the future, and we're seeing some examples of this, I think, where it still tends to be like within disease, like MDD with anxious distress. Like I think that's an indication that's currently being pursued by sponsors. MDD, you know, some of our work has looked, tried to sort of enriched for anhedonia in general as a enriched, but still within. We actually, when we would write some of these experimental medicine grants for NIMH, and we went all in, RDoC, transdiagnostic, we're going to study the neural circuits and the effect of treatment X on anhedonia across, even there when we limited to mood and anxiety spectrum, bipolar depression, unipolar, PTSD, anxiety, we got pushback from reviewers and stuff that said, well, how do you know the mechanisms of anhedonia are the same in unipolar depression, bipolar? So there's a lot of inertia to overcome also. Mm-hmm. So we sort of backed off and said, okay, we're going to look at anhedonia across depressive disorders. And we said you could have MDD, other depression. So we're sort of in this in-between period, let's say. It's hard to imagine the classic, the diagnoses really going away anytime soon. And I think it's, you know, what is it going to look like as we have more sort of our doc sort of domain transdiagnostic thinking, informed trials and informed labeling, but probably not replacing it for the foreseeable future.
Start small.
Yeah. Yeah. And exactly how that path is going to go, it's hard to tell. I don't know. But
Similarly, I think once we get past maybe this approval process, which we've discussed is going to take probably a little bit of time as we adjust, what do you think will become the role of psychotherapy for these medications where a lot of the experience is also part of the psychotherapy, and how do we implement that maybe as clinicians and psychiatrists, where you're not necessarily sitting with the patient for hours at a time and discussing everything with them? Mm-hmm. How is that, you know, how can we implement that to common clinical practice?
Yeah, I would love to sit at a round table or think tank with psychotherapists and get their opinion, because there's been such a divide in the psychiatric community with pure psychopharmacologists, you know, and psychiatrists who do psychotherapy. And there's a few who do both. I think I would love to get their opinion first.
And are you talking specifically in the context of sort of regulatory approval and then eventual use of psychedelics in the community?
Yeah, I think more just use in the community and how that will actually be implementable later on.
Yeah, it's a really, and this actually came up in your panel. Mm. And I think FDA and sponsors, I think they're not exactly sure what to do. It seems like there's sort of a standard model of, we could agree to at least call it psychological support, that's probably important for these compounds that cause profound, if transient, alterations in sense of self and just safety. So, you know, the classic serotonergic psychedelics like psilocybin, where you need a 6 to 8 hour period, it makes sense that the person is going to meet with once or twice with a trained psychotherapist or a trained person, and then sort of be with them during the experience and then have a few sessions. And even so, the panel today, Dr. McEwen that was presented was saying there's no specified therapy, but then when asked about it, she described a protocol that sounds very familiar, where a couple of prep sessions, supportive psychological support during treatment, and then 1 to 2 integration. So it's going to be some version of that. I think just there has to be some, I think the people that think it's just going to be a drug, that's going to be tough, unless, this is the big question, some people think you could engineer a drug to do all the good things that a psychedelic does, but they don't trip. Some people look at that and say, oh, that's a bit of a head scratcher. How's that working? So that's possible, though, and people are, and there is neurochemical reason to think, at least conceptually, that's possible. I think time will tell. But if we're talking about traditional psychedelics, there's going to be some role of that, whether we call it psychotherapy or psychological support. Is it semantic? I mean, but these are real practical issues that the field is going to be wrestling with.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Moreau and Dr. Hu, for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thanks a lot.
This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.